You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 25th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Karen Cox, author of No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. Meanwhile, Democrats have agreed to advance the $3.5 trillion budget resolution, allowing the House to begin writing that legislation, and also advanced the smaller package for a bipartisan vote with an arbitrary September 27th deadline to appease that mod squad. But House progressives have vowed to vote no on the bill if the larger package isn't yet agreed upon. The House also passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, a much less robust voting rights bill in H.R. 1, but it's DOA in the Senate because there's been no filibuster reform. Biden has stuck to his guns on the August 31st deadline to withdraw from Afghanistan and has said that over 70,000 people have been airlifted out of the country thus far. But not everyone's taking this withdrawal so well, including two congressmen, Democrat Seth Moulton and Republican Peter Meisher, who traveled to Afghanistan unauthorized in the middle of a dangerous evacuation as a political stunt. Both are veterans and both critical of the withdrawal, and apparently the military personnel said that they were unwelcome and were a distraction. COVID cases in children have increased exponentially in weeks in the United States, according to a report, up from around 38,000 cases a week at the end of July to over 180,000 cases last week. Vice President Kamala Harris was delayed in her Asian travels with a mysterious illness called Havana Syndrome, which coincidentally would be a great band name. And lastly, the Supreme Court upheld a ruling from a federal judge that requires the Biden administration to maintain Trump's Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is hump day, the newly coined phrase by me, myself, and I. You probably have never heard of it before. And Sam is out still. He will be back on Monday. We have got a great show for you today. The House came to an agreement on the budget resolution yesterday afternoon. Essentially, the chum that was given to that mod squad of right-wing Democrats who are holding up the bill for a variety of reasons, but most publicly, Josh Gottheimer is holding up the bill based on a tax benefit for wealthy households in blue states. And so the concession that they got was that there's a date set for September 27th for the bipartisan bill to be voted on. Now, a lot of people are saying that they're concerned that that the September 27th deadline is not enough time for the bipartisan bill to be agreed upon and the framework to come together. Now, that is a fair critique, and that doesn't necessarily matter, though, because the progressives say that they're going to vote no on the bipartisan bill if that framework isn't agreed to yet. So the deadline's entirely arbitrary. Pelosi gave it to the mod squad, as they like to be called, as a way to essentially get them off her back and move this process forward. We'll see how that pans out. But let's quickly turn to South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham, fresh off of his COVID diagnosis, and his quarantine made an appearance on Sean Hannity's program last night. He and John McCain, they used to double team this kind of talk, both inevitably reaching the conclusion that more aggression, more war, more bloodshed was necessary no matter what. So in McCain's absence, now that he has passed away, it seems that Graham has to ratchet things up to do double the work with an assist by Sean Hannity.
Senator, you know, we impeached Donald Trump over a phone call with Ukraine. Is that not an impeachable offense? Is this not rise to the level of dereliction of duty, abandoning Americans absolutely. In a foreign country, not getting them out when you had control of Kabul in May, June, July, not doing the right thing, getting them out, knowing they're on the march? There's no consequences for that except politically.
He should be impeached. This is dereliction of duty by the commander in chief. This makes it harder to fight future wars.
Good. My answer is it makes it harder to fight future wars. I'm fine with that. Maybe that'll give us some pause in terms of invading the next country for our own imperialist purposes. So now we're just throwing around impeachment for standard policy decisions. Let's just start with what Sean Hannity said, just calling what happened with Trump just a phone call. Like, doesn't the substance of a phone call matter, right? A phone call can be, you know, I'm calling grandma to see if she's doing all right. And then a phone call can be, I call up Matt and say, hey, put a hit on Bradley. I'll pay you $50,000 to make sure he sleeps with the fishes, eh? Right? That's a little bit substantively different than the first example. The Trump call was the result of a whistleblower revealing that Trump had blocked hundreds of millions of dollars in assistance that was congressionally mandated, that was supposed to go to Ukraine, unless they gave him dirt on Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, his potential political opponent. A bit different than just, you know, giving Zelensky a ring to say, what's up, dude? How you doing? And in terms of Biden being impeached for a standard decision about war when he committed no crimes here. In fact, I believe he did the just thing and the right thing. There are no good options in this kind of situation, given what the United States has created. But this was the only option that didn't involve a further occupation and endless involvement in a conflict that we should not be involved in.
Yeah, the occupation was a dishonorable crime, and the idea that you would have a good withdrawal from it, it's like a whole bunch of bank robbers, or like one set of bank robbers saying we shouldn't investigate part of their team that they're turning on for traffic violations in the getaway car.
Yeah.
Right? Like, no, we should be investigating this entire decision to go and waste a whole bunch of lives and money in a place that for no conceivable purpose, and this was known for a decade at least.
It's just like the sunk cost fallacy, and yet they're just the most, it's infected everybody. Like, everybody is convinced of this. It's not just something that you can point to, and it's completely made the rotted people's brains. Although Graham's brain in this area has been rotted for a while. Like, so he's saying Biden should be impeached for disengaging from Afghanistan. What's insane to me is that war crimes are considered lawfulness by Lindsey Graham. And backing down from a war is actually the crime. Orwellian is overused all the time, but I'm pretty sure war is peace, kind of exemplified by Graham's ideology here. He was cheerleading the Bush administration when they oversaw an illegal torture regime, and they murdered countless innocent people in an illegal war that was illegal from its outset, in the Iraq War. The Afghanistan War, it's a whole nother debacle. But he had a partisan option to critique Obama's drone war, which killed an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki, and his son. Nowhere to be found, Lindsey Graham there. He was, of course, nowhere to be found when Trump, who he originally said would be the death of the Republican Party and was a xenophobic bigot, and then came crawling back to him very quickly. He was nowhere to be found when Trump dropped the mother of all bombs without congressional approval, murdered an 8-year-old girl, or at least the operation he ordered murdered an 8-year-old girl in Yemen. Like, this is what's so creepy about his entire ideology. Disengaging from war, that's the real crime in the minds of deranged folks like Sean Hannity and Lindsey Graham. And it's just, it's a mental, like, warping that I cannot truly understand. But Graham's been consistent on it. This is who he is, and it's who he's been for quite a long time. And unfortunately, this guy's got a lot of power, and he's in our government. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by Karen Cox, author of No Common Ground: Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice.
Hi, folks. As you know, as Emma knows, summer's here and the living ain't easy if you have, say it with me, Emma, swamp ass. How are you going to stay on top of your sweaty bottom? Well, try a refreshing spray from a Hello Tushy bidet. You're going to keep yourself clean and fresh all summer long with the brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. We have spoken at length about the Hello Tushy bidet. I became bidet curious during COVID, and I have not looked back. Thank you. My own pun. It is stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is easy to install, and it saves you cheap-ass money. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean out your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself. It's got this smart spray automatic nozzle. And look, it attaches to your existing toilet. It's super easy. You lift up the seat, you slide it in, you put the seat back on. No electricity, no extra plumbing is needed. You know, you cut your toilet paper use by about 80%. It pays for itself in a few months because it's incredibly reasonably priced. Plus, the Hello Tushy has your ass covered with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. If you already got a Hello Tushy on the pot, well, time to upgrade to that 3.0 model. And if you're new to the revolution, know that you're joining millions of happy Hello Tushy customers, and you are you're cleaning yourself with water as opposed to just dry paper. There's a reason why we don't wash our hands with dry paper. Believe me, folks. Once you go bidet, there's no other way. I don't know. Defeat swamp ass. Go to hellotushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. Emma?
We are back. And I would like to welcome to the program Karen Cox, author of No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. Karen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, well, I'm excited we finally got someone on this program to talk about this very topic, because in reading your book, I was so unaware of, I guess, how this debate has been raging for quite a while, and it was a bit more concentrated in local activism and politics than the national conversation when it kind of sprung to the forefront in the mid-2010s. So I guess just from a 30,000-foot view, if you could talk about how looking at Confederate monuments, you were able to kind of track or look at the history of racism in this country through that specific lens, through these flare-ups of this debate, through quieter moments, and how that was useful in analyzing this.
Yeah, so I think the common myth that, you know, and that goes out there today is that people were only protesting Confederate monuments since Black Lives Matter was formed in 2014. And the reality is there's a much longer history of that happening that goes back to the time the first Confederate monuments were erected. So what you will see is that Confederate monuments appear, the vast majority were erected in the 1890s. This is a significant decade because it is a decade of extreme racial violence and lynching across the South. And then, and immediately there's a move toward legalizing segregation and there's voter disfranchisement of Black men and kind of dialing back the 15th Amendment. And you'll see these kinds of things flare up every so often throughout the 20th century. We see it again, obviously, during the civil rights era. And you have, this is also the period in the early 60s of the Civil War centennial. But it's been ongoing. Once the Voting Rights Act passed, and communities were able to elect officials that looked like them, we have Black officials and local city councils, they began to challenge Confederate iconography on the grounds of courthouses. And you see that happening beginning in the 1970s. You've seen it, you know, since 2000. And so, again, there's a long history of this back and forth about Confederate monuments. The monuments only express one narrative, that is the narrative of whites of the white South or white Southerners who believe that, for example, slavery was not a cause of the Civil War, etc.
Well, yeah, I guess that's a useful place to start with the lost cause ideology driving this forward in the late part of the 1800s. Talk about, I guess, Edward A. Pollard, his influence over this kind of movement and how ubiquitous or just, I guess, present the ideology of lost causism became in the wake of the Civil War. And interestingly, too, like you also write about how these monuments weren't erected right after the Civil War. It took a few years, some period of time. We can, I guess, get to that in a bit, but I'm curious about that whole period.
Okay, so Edward Pollard was a journalist, a Richmond journalist, who wrote a book called The Lost Cause, and it was meant to be a history of the Civil War, but from the Southern perspective, and he kind of lays out what he believes that had happened, you know, and he immediately is clear that he doesn't believe, you know, that the war was ever about slavery, and he basically says at the end of that book that nothing's been decided here except military defeat, and certainly, as he put it in that time, Negro equality had not been decided, although this was before Reconstruction and the amendments that gave the 14th Amendment and then the 15th Amendment, which gave Black men the right to vote. But that lost cause narrative that it develops immediately after the war is an effort for white Southerners to try to come to terms with defeat. They couldn't even imagine that they were going to be defeated. Right. So how can they justify it? And so they justify it by saying, well, it wasn't about, you know, the war was never about slavery. All Confederates are turned into heroes. All the leaders, you know, people like General Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, they're the most iconic of the lost cause heroes. And they're sort of both figuratively and literally placed on pedestals as representative of Southern men. So in that scenario, then it's really romanticizes someone like Lee, but also helps assuage defeat, helps white Southerners come to term with that. And it's also sort of, it develops, again, each generation adds to the narrative. And then it develops into something that coincides with white supremacy and the growth of white supremacy in the South in a cultural way, but also politically. So the lost cause is essentially a series of false narratives about what the war was about, making heroes out of all men, you know, making light of slavery as though this was a benign institution. That the Ku Klux Klan of Reconstruction are also recognized as heroes in this narrative. And as I said, each, you know, and the thing about it is that it begins to enter into the conversation among politicians, but it's also part of the thing that happens with children, and that there's this effort that people immediately recognize that the way forward out of this, and the way so that, you know, future Southerners don't get this narrative twisted in any other way except that this was not only a lost cause but a just cause,
right?
Then, you know, the problem is, and the why it has such staying power and why we still hear these kinds of myths today, is because a group like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which put up most of those monuments in the late 19th, early 20th century, were also engaged in I would say, a disinformation campaign of rewriting history so that, you know, future generations of white Southerners would grow up and see it the same way that their ancestors had.
Yeah, talk a bit about more about the Daughters of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, because I was fascinated to read that Southern white women were pretty instrumental in this project to get these monuments erected.
Yes, you know, monuments were being erected almost immediately after the Civil War. They were. Most of the early ones were placed in cemeteries where the Confederate dead are buried. And those were the Ladies Memorial Associations. But the United Daughters of the Confederacy becomes the second generation of white women who are engaged in this campaign to essentially to vindicate their ancestors. And so these are generally middle-class, upper-class white women. They're married or related to men of power in the region, everywhere from, you know, the local judge to U.S. senators. And they have a lot of power, and they're consummate fundraisers. And they're the ones who are placing Confederate monuments. They're marking the entire landscape. The Southern landscape is just saturated with Confederate memorials. And so it's not just monuments, it's school names, it's street names, it's all kinds of things. But monuments are the most obvious, tangible reminders of their influence. And between, you know, 1895 and the First World War, that's when the vast majority go up. And that is also the same time period that the UDC is on the rise in its growth as an organization. So by World War One, that group was 100,000 women. Their membership was really, really large, and they had a lot of political influence, and they could, even at a time when women couldn't vote, they had political influence. But it was really around this issue of Confederate memorialization. So they, you know, we know everything from, there's a Confederate monument in Arlington National Cemetery. There's, you know, there are these large ones, the ones what we know about on Monument Avenue. And then of course, there's those that are at local courthouses. Because ultimately, the monuments are really local objects, and that's where the battle is taking place.
You mentioned that in 1890 to the early parts of the 20th century, the United Daughters of the Confederacy were growing exponentially. That also was the same time period that the KKK was growing, I would say, in prominence, I believe. I don't have the figures in front of me, but the height of their membership came at the beginning of the 20th century, if I'm wrong. I'm guessing. I'm asking for your take on that. Was that a parallel kind of growth, both groups?
Well, so that was the second Klan, the second version of the Klan, or second iteration of the Klan. And it was a little bit different than the Klan of Reconstruction, which is tended to be the group that the UDC tended to hold in high esteem. But that time period is like this is a period of nativism in the United States, you know, a concern over immigration, over, you know, and of course, in 1915, you have the Birth of a Nation comes out in theaters as the, you know, the most successful silent film of all time. And that also, you know, leads is instrumental to the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. It's second, you know, kind of rebirth of the Klan in 1915. And the UDC was certainly very supportive of that film and liked what they saw in the movie. But, you know, they tended to be sort of, they in part distanced themselves from the Second Klan, mainly because of over class issues. They saw these as like lower class, you know, whites and others that are participating in the second iteration of the Klan, whereas the first Klan were heroes because they were like generals and they were, you know, really represented more, you know, kind of the elite of white men in the South. It's a weird thing, but you know, that's kind of how they looked at it.
And in terms of the substance of what they were pushing for, was there any difference, like the class-based differential between these two iterations of the clans? Like, how did that play itself out in terms of what they were pushing for?
Who was pushing for?
The first iteration of the clan and the next.
Well, I mean, in terms of what the UDC thought, I don't know, but since that I didn't write about the Klan, I wrote about the UDC's relationship with the Klan, which is very clear from the first Klan than it is to the second Klan.
Gotcha.
Because these women were themselves were, like, as I said, middle and upper class. And so they tend to see these as sort of like, you know, lower class guys and that were involved in that second Klan. And they didn't want to be associated with that second Klan. Although, you know, again, the first Klan to them was okay. You know, they were okay with that. And the racial violence that they exacted on Black Southerners during Reconstruction.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's also was interesting to me was how Black Americans at this time were aware of this concerted kind of effort to erect these monuments. And there was a response in terms of written publications and, you know, Black intellectuals at the time speaking out about this. Mm-hmm. Talk about their response.
Yeah. So, again, in the period of Jim Crow in particular, you know, Black Southerners would have risked their lives if they had tried to protest a Confederate monument. They could have been lynched for that. And so what you see is that it's not that Black Southerners were okay with Confederate monuments. They never were. Now, you did see in the late 19th century in Richmond, Virginia, an editor of the Richmond Planet, which was the African-American paper there, John Mitchell Jr., comes out and says, you know, he's talking about the unveiling of the enormous Lee Monument on Monument Avenue in Richmond. He said, this is a signal of bad things to come for the Black community. And it was, as meant Black men were being disfranchised. And then you see, though, the way you'll see sort of critiques of monuments, they come out not just among Black leaders, you know, like W.E.B. Du Bois, but also among just regular Black Southerners who are writing in to the Chicago Defender, which is the national Black newspaper of the time. And it's in the 20s and 30s. And they're saying these monuments are, how in the world do we have such things? Why these people were treasonous? They, you know, they violated their oath to West Point, you know, somebody like Robert E. Lee. And so why would we do this? And so there's a lot of criticism around the monuments and, you know, this belief that having those monuments in place is the reason that things are so bad in terms of race relations, you know, because these monuments, as someone wrote into the Defender, said that remind Southern children, meaning Southern white children, you know, that they are somehow superior. And this is the thing about monuments, is that they weren't about history. They weren't about looking back. They're about looking forward. There's a nod to history, but the real purpose is to create symbols that people will revere, and future generations, is the hope, will learn these lessons and admire these people.
Right, which was a part of why it was also interesting to hear that the, like, targeted defacing of these Confederate statues was also something that was nothing new, right?
Right.
Like, again, the national conversation about it is really just burgeoning in the past decade or so, but there were activists that would deface these monuments historically. Talk about that.
Well, what you would see is that once the Civil Rights Act had passed, the Voting Rights Act had passed, what you begin to see is that people are testing out the Voting Rights Act, for example. You know, the Meredith March, the Delta of Mississippi in 1966, very often when as they, and this is about registering voters, as they enter into these towns, into the Delta, basically the center of town is usually the Confederate monument, whether it's, you know, on a main boulevard or it's on the courthouse lawn. Where do you register to vote? At the courthouse, right? And so what you will see is the marchers basically reclaiming space, reclaiming public space around Confederate monuments. And then we saw there was an incident in Tuskegee, Alabama that I write about, the murder of Sammy Young, who had been a student at Tuskegee. And when the white man who murdered him was acquitted, as they all kind of thought that would happen, the students marched into the town of Tuskegee from the university and at that evening and surrounded it and began to deface it. They took black paint and slung it on the monument and painted Black Power on the side of the monument. And so, I think what it is about these kinds of incidents that it's like symbolizes and helps us understand that Black Southerners had always known and always believed that these were offensive, these were racist, and these were icons of white supremacy in their community.
And how, I mean, you talked a bit about Reconstruction, but I just wanted to flesh that out a little bit. Like, you know, did this neatly coincide with the effort to end Reconstruction? Was this sort of an empowerment for these Southerners as Reconstruction was on the outs?
Are you talking about monuments themselves?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, not in the period of Reconstruction itself. So you have this sort of phases of monument building. And so during the period of Reconstruction, which lasts from the end of the Civil War to 1877, what you'll see are just the monuments are primarily located in cemeteries. Once Reconstruction ends and most of the federal troops have left the region, then you begin to see why Southerners say, okay, let's, you know, bring these monuments out into the open, sort of out into the main thoroughfare, or, you know, it becomes more celebratory. So it's sort of, a middle finger to Reconstruction in a way, once these troops are gone. And so you begin to see more of a celebratory mood around monument building until you get to the 1890s when the UDC is formed. Then this becomes about vindication. It's more than just about celebrating heroes and commemorating heroes. Now it becomes about what do we do, you know, as a region going forward. We're not just going to say, put a monument up. These monuments have to say something about these men as heroes, but vindicate them from defeat, you know. And so what you'll see is in monument unveilings, you'll have these speeches being given, and they're talking very openly about maintaining white supremacy at the unveiling of the monument. It was like, right, that's what they're celebrating, and also encouraging that be, you know, defended going forward.
So I want to jump a little bit ahead to the civil rights era, where I think a lot of people might assume that a lot of these monuments as homages or reinforcers of white supremacy were erected during that time. But that doesn't seem to be the case, or that it wasn't the case. Talk about that dynamic, if you could.
Yeah, so there is a narrative out there that somehow there was an explosion of monuments that took place during the civil rights era. And so in the 1950s and 1960s, we only saw about, I think we saw about 40 new monuments go up. Now, some of those were during the Civil War centennial, 1961 to 65. So about 20 in each decade. So that's not like the same as on the early Jim Crow period, where you might see, you know, 400 go up in a, you know, or 200 go up in a year.
Right.
That's a lot. But what you see is the ways in which these Confederate symbols, these monuments, are being used by new generations of people. So maybe in the 50s, you know, instead of getting a speech about Confederate heroes, you know, on Confederate Memorial Day, what you hear is in Mississippi and Vicksburg, for example, a speech by state politicians saying, talking about communism, talking about, you know, you know, protecting the state's reputation as they see, you know, from federal intrusion over the issue of civil rights. So it's a way in which these things kind of gain a new life in a different setting and in a different historical context. And then there were those, you know, cases I mentioned about the ways in which, on the flip side of that, how the existing monuments, and that's really what we're seeing, what you see in that period is how existing monuments become, you know, sort of revamped in terms of the way people think about them. And so again, on the one hand, it could be about, you know, anti-communism. On the other hand, it's about civil rights marchers reclaiming public space that's in their community because they want the right to vote.
Right, right. And maybe it also just kind of speaks to how the civil rights era was a period where maybe the white supremacists were a bit on the defense in that area. Like, at least in terms of erecting these monuments, it was a bit more of a political kind of fight than trying to erect these monuments to create some sort of preservation of white supremacy, if that makes any sense. I'm not sure it does. But what percentage was it? Something like 5% of the known monuments were erected in that era? A very small percentage, as you say.
I don't know what the percentage is. I just know that there was only about 20 in 1950s and another 20 in the 1960s. And so, and by comparison, there were 35 new monuments built since 2000.
Gotcha. Right. So then I guess we can fast forward to that period of time where that was the next influx of the creation of some of these monuments. What did you glean from that?
Well, I think what's happening, what you see is that when white Southerners see like there's any kind of racial progress happening, you know, you begin to get a backlash, and this is a political backlash, but then it gets represented through monuments, for example. So in, you know, in the 1990s, we began to see the first, efforts at gerrymandering in the South. Mm-hmm. And there's this sense that, okay, there's been enough progress now since the Voting Rights Act of 65. We got to slow this down and maybe even turn it around and turn it backward. And so monuments are sort of representative of that. What's different in since 2000 is that the new monuments that are built are primarily on private property. They're not on the public square, or they might be in cemeteries. And the reason, I mean, honestly, the public square has been, was like covered by the UDC back, you know, 100 years before. So it's what you begin to see. You begin to see pretty early on in the early 2000s an effort to try to either move a monument or at least get it contextualized. There was just, you know, people were just not having it. You know, it's like the defenders of monuments didn't even want, you know, a contextual panel, so that we've now gotten to the point where such things, you know, aren't even, you know, worth the effort. And plus there's this, you know, a contextual panel, because a lot of people say, well, why don't you just do that? Why don't you just put a panel next to the monument and say, this is what this really stood for. Well, there's an optics problem when, you know, you have a little 6-foot panel with some wording on it, and it's, but it's standing next to a 30-foot monument. You know, it's just like that narrative, even in the visual of that narrative, is unequal. So, you know, we're what we've gotten to, though, of course, is that we're at a point where not that they're being built, but now they're at the center of a controversy of the ones that already exist. And what do we do? And communities that want to move them are being, you know, thwarted by state monument laws that prevent their removal.
And also, I mean, you mentioned this a bit earlier, like the monuments in and of themselves are not the only structural, I guess, odes to white supremacy that exist. I mean, there are street names, there are buildings, there are all of these. I mean, Washington and Lee College is one that's quite prominent that comes to mind among a bunch of other universities and buildings. I guess just maybe talk a little bit about how that's a bit of the tip of the iceberg. This is quite widespread and quotidian in parts of the country.
Yeah, so, you know, Confederate monuments are just one aspect of Confederate memorialization. They are obviously the most tangible, the most reminders and evidence of Confederate memorialization. But as you said, we've got street names, we have schools named for Confederate heroes, we have any number of what in some ways, in the way that the UDC works is like anything could be a monument, right? Like even a school, right? And rename a school after Robert E. Lee, and that becomes a monument of a sort. And it just varies the way from place to place, how people want to handle that. In Texas, I heard about a school, there was an effort to rename a Robert E. Lee, you know, elementary or middle school, and local school board voted against it. In Charlotte, North Carolina, where I live, the mayor appointed a group called the Legacy Commission. And while Charlotte is not known for its monuments, it does have many streets named for former Confederates. And so there actually is a genuine effort to change street names in the city. So it just varies from place to place and depending on the will of leadership.
Right. And it does vary from place to place. And it's also not necessarily confined to the South because, you know, there are places all over the country, Confederate flags on police badges in South Dakota. There's as an example our producer Matt pointed out. There's a variety of places that have these homages. So, I mean, if what accounts for that, except for the fact that this is really about white supremacy and not Southern heritage.
Right. So we all know that, you know, what happened in Charlottesville in 2017 was a gathering of white supremacists and white nationalists. This was not, they came and said, we're here to defend, you know, the removal of the Robert E. Lee monument. But the vast majority of those guys were not even from the South, have no, you know, links to Confederate heritage or Southern heritage at all. This was about white supremacy. The North and white Northerners and white Americans across the country have long been complicit in some ways with the Lost Cause. They don't mind employing the symbols of the Lost Cause, especially the Confederate battle flag. Whether or not they have a monument doesn't mean much. There are Confederate monuments all over the country, in the North as well as the South, although the most are in the South. But the Confederate battle flag, which is, you know, can be purchased anywhere, can be printed on anything, you know, it's highly mobile, and it's a symbol of intimidation. It's not only a symbol of white supremacy, but a symbol of intimidation. And you see it, you know. I talk about in the book about, you know, a protest against in the Bronx, in which all these guys, these white guys that you know, were waving Confederate battle flags. You could have, like, that images from that could have been from Birmingham, Alabama, but they were from the Bronx. Battle flags are all over the place in the North. And so there, you know, it is a symbol of white supremacy. You know, and people talk about the history of it. It's like, there was only a 4-year period where it was actually used in, you know, in a military sense. There's been over 150 years, 160 years of it being used on behalf of white supremacy.
Right, right. That's what it stands for. And, you know, you talk about Charlottesville and how that brought people from all over the country. It's a great example of how national this has become and how it's transitioned from more local acts of erecting a monument, maybe protests and defacing of that monument, to now we're having a national conversation about what these symbols mean. Maybe take us more to 2014, the creation of Black Lives Matter, to now, and how this debate has evolved.
Sure. I think, you know, obviously Black Lives Matter was, you know, in response to other things that are happening. But I tell you what happened. It was the Charleston massacre in 2015 that really changed the game. It changed everything because, you know, the images of the murderer, whose name I don't like to mention, is with a Confederate battle flag draped over his shoulder. That is what led to and eventually led to the removal of the Confederate battle flag from the grounds of the Capitol in South Carolina. But it was that event, that tragedy, that in the summer in which prior to the 2016 election, in which all these Republican candidates for president were put on the spot about what do you do about these things. And so it became a national conversation when that happened. And it hasn't gone away since, you know. And so anytime you think it's about to kind of die down, so 2015, that was a terrible tragedy. Things calmed down. Then you have 2017, you have Charlottesville. Things calmed down a little bit more. Then you had George Floyd murder in 2020. I this has been the pattern of the last several years, 6 years, this back and forth and back and forth. And there are these flare-ups. And the flare-ups, obviously, around racial inequality, around systemic racism, around police brutality, et cetera. And Confederate symbols, flags and monuments are often at the center of that in the South. But again, beyond the South, that, you know, battle flags show up in protest, you know, with the Proud Boys, or for example, you know, or, you know, they're carrying not only Confederate battle flags, but Nazi flags.
What's interesting, too, to me about this conversation is rationalizing with white supremacy is probably not the right route to go down. But, you know, don't erase our history. This is our history. At the start of our interview and at the start of your book, we're talking about an ahistory, an ahistorical account that motivated this hagiography of these Confederate generals. Like, it's so interesting to me how ahistorical mythology is treated as history in order for these racists to kind of work backwards from their own white supremacist views.
Yeah, it's, you know, we have a saying that the, you know, the South lost the war, the Civil War, but won the peace. And the way they won it was through the lost cause. And they couldn't have enjoyed, you know, this, the longevity of the lost cause could not have been possible without complicity on the part of white Northerners, who also engaged in some amnesia around the Civil War and what it had been fought for and the outcomes of the war, like emancipation. I mean, Frederick Douglass was, you know, very concerned about that. He saw that happening and pushed against it until his death in 1895. And so, you know, it lets us know, like, just the staying power of that narrative is kind of phenomenal. It really is. But it also, if you think about today and the ways in which people are pushing back against what they're calling critical race theory, right? So this has become the buzzword. But what it's really about is saying we don't want people to be educated to know the real history, because if they knew the real history, then they might, you know, buck up against white power structures. You know,
right.
And this is not about making anybody feel bad about their race, right? This is about let's be honest and have an honest conversation about the history of this country. And there is nothing wrong with that. There is a lot of ugly to it. And but, you know, again, the Lost Cause was a campaign of disinformation. And so is this current, you know, milieu that we're in around education. It's a disinformation campaign that somehow we're teaching this to children. It's not even taught in K-12. You know, it's a theory that gets taught in you know, at the college level. But regardless, it's like they understand that knowledge is power. And if we can't have the real knowledge, is that we're going to give you this superficial, this mythological information. And that's a way of maintaining power, political power.
Right.
And that's what the white Southerners used for generations after generation to maintain their power in the South. You know, and now we're seeing, you know, like we're seeing it on a national scale in this way. Let's only teach about the founding fathers. Let's only teach about American history as though it was all, everything was nice and there were no dark periods. It's, you know, that kind of stuff.
Lastly, do you have optimism? You know, the Mississippi flag shift, the Confederate monuments do seem to be coming down in some fashion, not at the rate they should be, but...
Well, you know, here's the thing, you know, it really boils down to like who controls politics in the state and, you know, and so with these Republican dominated legislatures, we're not, you know, that have instituted laws that prohibit the changing of things, you know, moving a monument or what, or taking one down, that's to me is disheartening. I mean, the removal of that one symbol. Okay, let's remove. Even if today we were able to remove every Confederate monument, we have not healed people in terms of their what they think about race and their in race relations in this country. I mean, the conversation has to be. It's not about the symbols, you know. It's about the real, you know, the real issues of racism and white supremacy and this just like this cultural and political divide that we exist in at this moment.
Karen Cox, her book is called No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. Karen, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate
sure.
it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break and we will be back to wrap things up. We are back to wrap things up here for all of you lovely folks on Peacock. Let's go to Fox News again. We got to do this. We got to monitor what's going on over there at that complete insane asylum. Kayleigh McEnany, former, of course, White House spokesperson under Trump, was on Fox News yesterday with Jesse Waters, and she made a claim that elicited some laughs, and you'll understand why.
Right. We are 8 months into a Biden presidency, Jesse. Wrap your head around that. We still have 3 years and 4 months left. Look, when President Trump was president, you didn't see crisis after crisis. You just didn't see it.
It's very kind of alarming how they just reflect talking points from like the like 4 years ago, because this is what people were saying when it was, you know, like people went to airports to protest the Muslim ban, for instance.
Right.
Like that was quite disruptive. Completely self-inflicted sort of scandal or whatever. And it was people saying, you know, I remember under Obama, I didn't have to do this. They're literally just, it's like they cut and paste.
Yeah, well, they also, I mean, they don't necessarily want to, they do cut and paste, right? And like everybody that's watching that is going to nod in agreement. Yes, you're absolutely right. Under Donald Trump, we did not see the mass mismanagement of coronavirus. We did not see him encourage people to inject bleach into their body and throw that out there as a possible solution to the pandemic that has now killed over 600,000 Americans and millions of people worldwide.
He wasn't getting in pissing contests, or Trump was getting in pissing contests with like veterans, people who dead veterans' parents, like, right, the Gold Star families.
Right, but the thing about that is that, well, imagine if that happened with a Democratic president, of course, but, like, they want to play all of those things off of, and by two impeachments in the House, they want to play all of that off as, okay, you know, this is just media manufactured scandals for Donald Trump. Under Biden, we're seeing real concrete ones. And the reality is that, yes, we are still dealing with the pandemic. Could the CDC have dealt with things a little bit better, potentially not dropping mask mandates for the vaccinated that early on? Yes, we can quibble with that. But the vaccine rollout in this country, it's unconscionable what we've done worldwide, has been good. The withdrawal from Afghanistan was a good thing. Even though, of course, there is going to be a fallout from us propping up a government for quite a while and then that vacuum being filled once we leave, but it had to be done. And so, like, that's all they can hang their hat on. What's the next crisis going to be? Kamala Harris's laugh? Like, there are quibbles to be made and real criticisms of Biden from the left that we could engage in, but they're not going to engage in that. So they just always, like, work themselves up as actors in like acting school to get outraged, right? They really, what's the method of acting where you react and you live in every experience? I'm forgetting
Method acting.
No, that's not method acting. It's you're in character the whole time. There's like something about losing, I forget. It's some fancy technique, but they're experts in it. They didn't even need to go to acting school because they're able to completely feel this outrage. It's got to be authentic, even if they know it's pretty much BS. All right, guys. Thanks for the Peacock audience. For the rest of you, we'll see you in a bit. Peacock audience, we will see you tomorrow. All right. Now we are alone.
I had some things to say about the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing a lot of reading about Bismarck, North Dakota. Founded 1873, so post-Civil War, when the trains had finally extended Northern Pacific Railroad. Northern Pacific Railroad was surveyed by Thomas Lafayette Rosser, who was the Confederate cavalry general who was hired by the Northern Pacific Railroad to run, you know, the line. And Custer, of course, was also across the river in from Bismarck at Fort Mandan, Fort Abraham Lincoln. They had actually taken part in a battle against each other during the Civil War, but they were West Point classmates, so they were like sort of friendly and stuff like that. Like Custer waved to him and stuff. But anyway, the whole point of this is that we reconciled way too quickly with the wrong people after the Civil War in the name of unity. And you see that rhetoric all over the newspapers of the time saying, oh, this was all behind us and done now. We need to come together and basically exterminate Native Americans, which is fundamentally what that why you have two generals, cavalry generals taking part in, you know, formation of a town is because, you know, you're going to have to go deal with the Lakota and Nakota and Dakota Sioux. So yeah, it I don't know. I like whenever I hear moderates talk about unity, I think of two cavalry generals, a Confederate and a Union guy coming together to form Bismarck and it's not
and murder a bunch of Native Americans.
Murder a bunch of Native Americans and basically continue the genocide of I don't want to say this, I forget the full name, the Mendewakan, I can't think
it's
of
okay.
the name, but anyway, yeah, and continue that and, you know, also do some infrastructure. So yeah, I mean that's the problem with unity, I think, in this country where we have a whole class of people that is devoted to white supremacy.
Great point. We have a Louis Gohmert, eco-crusader, writes in Meisner. That was the technique I was thinking of. Thank you very much. It's not method acting. It's not method acting. It's not. It's different. That's method acting is the term for the complete emotional identification of the part, says Sam's sad sabbatical. Anyway, I appreciate everybody writing in, trying to quench my curiosity on that part. Matt, what's happening over on Left Reckoning? You're doing your stream tonight, right?
Yeah, tonight Chip Gibbons talking about civil liberties, Assange, Daniel Hale. We'll also be talking about an old Nixon tape the morning of the release of the Pentagon Papers and if things have gotten better or worse, maybe, for whistleblowers since then. Kissinger appears. So that's tonight at 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central, Literary Hangover YouTube channel, patreon.com/literary hangover.
All right, check out the Nomiki show, and it's 646-257-3920. See you all in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
No! Oh, no! Are you ready?
Oh, yeah! Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them,
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday! My birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are black. Black. Africans are back. Back.
Come on! Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy. Total, pussy, 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 total, pussy.